Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the listening comfort of the Five Eyes surveillance networks. It's a dirty job, but somebody's got to do it. My very special guest is Thane Kirby, I guess creator of George FM, would that be fair to say?
Yeah, pretty much. I've just been calling myself founder. And then, creating the format, getting it together, and then eventually selling it to the beloved Media Works.
the beloved Media Works, who then kicked off. I remember one thing about Media Works or something like that. There was a George host who'd been like on radio for like 9 years or something like that. And then one weekend he went away on holiday or something, and then when he came back, they'd given his slot to John Key's son or something like that. And I was just like, oh, that's so rough, bro. How sad is that? But anyway, out of your hands.
Not my problem. Okay.
It's just, it's the same thing that happens to my dad's business and so many other creators. And the reason I use creator is because people create stuff out of nothing. They will it into fucking existence, right? And then when somebody else takes it over, as soon as the creator leaves, everything goes to shit, essentially. I've seen it happen so many fucking times, man. Whatever made it what it was is not what it is anymore. Might be a bit presumptuous.
No, I couldn't agree more. I mean, remember when I left George to start Alt TV, I think it was back in 2006, and everything was perfect. It was all kind of set up for George, and then everybody kind of went away for one survey period, and it just felt like the heart and soul had kind of left the building, and they threw the kitchen sink and billboards, we're doing this and we're doing that, and the whole thing sunk in the ratings, and then I kind of came back and just started the rebuild again, and then it kicked off yet again. But I suppose a creator does bring heart and soul to it, a certain level of creativity and a connection with the audience, you know, and either you got it or you don't got it. And if you don't got it, you're going to spend years trying to get it. So once you find it, it's an amazing thing.
Well, I just wonder, what was the actual story of the true creation? Why did you actually do it? Because there's so many other people who dream of creating their own radio networks and don't fucking do it.
Yeah, it was a time and place in Auckland where there were FM frequencies available. I remember Life FM 99.8, I think, was up for grabs. And you know, you had to pay pretty much, say, $600 to $1 million for frequency. And I was doing a overnight, it was a place called Media, it was I-98, and I was like the kind of part-time announcer guy. I would just kind of do any shift, no matter what format it was. I was on FM Country, I was working for The Breeze, I was doing all kinds of radio Hauraki at the time, or Hauraki now. And I just thought, I can't get a radio gig. The only way I'm going to get an actual really good radio gig is to start my own radio station. And quite literally back then, I took the music that was popular on Ponsonby Road that hadn't been absorbed by commercial radio and kind of said, let's go with that. So then it pretty much started with an idea and then telling people a whole lot of different stories until we all kind of came together and got it together, from investigating how can we transmit this, how do we have to do it legally, how can I do it illegally, swapping out microphones and Alice Worsley's studio until I got my actual AKG mic that was broadcast, and just putting an old Dick Smith shitter in, and just trying to build a brand slowly. I wanted to keep everything simple, like even right down to the logo that I designed, because it was cheap. I just needed to, something was just Arial bold, you know what I mean? So it was just, it was organic, and it was being built as we needed it. And then there were a lot of people who couldn't get on BFM at the time. There were a lot of people who were disgruntled with BFM because it was the only kind of independent outlet. You had to be a big radio announcer with a big radio voice at the time, which I just didn't have, that big kind of like, the, you know, Radio Hour Ranking, all that kind of stuff. And so, yeah, I thought this is going to be my opportunity. So build it yourself. And so, yeah, getting volunteers, they came out of the hills, and it was a real team effort at the end of the day. And then finally, I managed to stitch together, from moving from a little bedroom in Grey Lynn to Ponsonby Road and then to now where George is at 105 Ponsonby Road, doing a joint venture with a Māori group who had a license, getting that re-engineered. Like, these things couldn't be done today because, you know, it's only owned by NZME Radio, it's taken over by MediaWorks. And so just finding opportunities and like-minded people from our tech guys who really, you know, radio, again, they were just old Radio New Zealand guys, an independent guy called Barry Ewins, who could just make it happen or think about how he could make it happen before it even existed, was incredible stuff. George used to do a lot of outside broadcasts and used to touch the community a lot, backing events and what have you. So, yeah, team effort, just throwing everything you had at it. Why not?
How did you feel that it was coordinated centrally? I mean, what I was thinking about, like, because I'm now executive producer of American Freedom Radio, and I've got to run this radio network and things like that. And there's a lot of personalities. There's a lot of potential conflict. I wonder how important is it to try and mitigate those conflicts of personalities, and indeed how to do that.
Well, I kind of, it's a real people game, like you're saying. I would, especially with talent, I would kind of know what their hotkeys were. This guy's in it because he wants to be a big-time DJ. This guy's in it because he needs money. This person, this lady's in it because she wants to be the next. I mean, in the commercial radio situation I was running, you come in as a sales rep and then probably leave as a kind of, some kind of DJ. No one ever wanted to sell advertising. No one wanted to do the hard stuff or be a part of the backbone. And then if you found people who did, they were like really car salesmen, real estate agent type people. And so you had to feed them. That's my family's having a get together inside. You had to kind of like play on their hot buttons. What do you want? Be straight up about it. And then just consistently manage their expectations. And then tell people, the worst thing is stringing people along. I was just literally going to say, you're not going to end up here. You're not going to be a millionaire out of this. If you want to do that, you've got to go somewhere else. But if you want to, this will be great on your CV, and this is all I can give you this time. And also, there was a slight bit of exploitation. If I knew someone was really good there, I wanted to keep them in that position as long as possible. You know, so I've been the greatest person, and I've been someone's worst nightmare. Anyone in management would probably be the same.
Well, it's said that in order to control people, you need to balance the nature of the meek gentleman and the brutal warrior, you know.
Yeah.
You kind of have to be prepared to fight for that kind of stuff, and be prepared to actually crack a few skulls if freaking necessary, metaphysically speaking. But I wonder as well what kind of mentality perhaps separates. There's always good and evil, right? Or at least a lot of people believe in this accentuating concept. Let's say theoretically you're what would be noted as a good radio producer, somebody who does actually really, really care about the game. And then there's other people who have perhaps a similar skill level, but they don't come up from the same consciousness level. How do they treat their staff versus how you would treat somebody?
I've come from a scenario. I just have finished a job at The Rock, and it's a radio station in New Zealand, plays rock music. These people 100% live and breathe the Rock brand. They wear the merchandise. They sing from the same prayer book. They're dedicated. Their whole mission is like they're there to win the America's Cup, and they give their all. And if you have show any kind of weakness, dishonesty, then you're pushed out to the album. I think me as a radio announcer, I would probably wouldn't accept somebody who wasn't totally getting me or kind of down with my vibe or getting what I needed to make great radio. So if I could, I used to be able to kind of, I used to call it like the Thane Kirby School of Radio. I could mold people into being the super producer that I needed. And then I could shake out the commercial radio-ness of them all, and then we could all get along. And then there's some people who were just so by the book that I had to kind of like tank them. So I guess if you're really good at producing, stay a producer, because that's what this radio world needs right now. If you're not going to give everything
for the radio, your truthfulness, your genuine life, your opinions, then don't bother with the radio. You got to work out why you're in radio, if you want to be famous, if you've got something to say, or if you're just naturally gifted that way, then yeah, totally be on the radio. If you're in it for the money and what have you, again, I suppose this applies to every job, and it's probably going to be a waste of time. I've gone from being an absolute no one to being on Radio New Zealand at the top of the kind of like MediaWorks corporate radio structure, and I'm always out with my hat. My head out asking for a few more dollars. You know, it's still not amazing, but I turned some pretty good radio, I find, for the brief that I was given. I've turned out, you know, won a radio award when I was working for The Rock. I've never won a radio award before, but I ticked every box that commercial radio needed, and I put the hard yards in, because before that I was just a lazy fuck. I was there pretty much for the free booze and what have you. But I've ticked all the corporate boxes, and I ended up walking away with the award in my first radio survey, you know, on a new radio show on a nationwide station. So, I mean, if you can put in the hard work and stay at it, you're probably going to end somewhere. But to be a producer, I reckon producing is such a cool job. Just work, develop a genuine friendship with your host, and just understand what the whole show brief is and just keep to it. And again, genuine interviews. I reckon talk radio needs a shake-up, and it's the people behind the microphone, it's the people leading the charge and the programming that need to kind of like kick it out there. It's boring as fuck. I listen to commercial radio, they've got 80-year-olds on, and it's, you know, especially in talk format, and people who I'm sure haven't walked down most of the main streets of New Zealand, shook the hands of real New Zealanders. I reckon they just get make their view and world opinion from the news that they're fed at 6 o'clock, you know what I mean? Oh, is that really what's going on? And okay. Where they've got to get out and meet some people and live some life. I personally believe the best broadcasters in the country, the ones who've been through the worst trauma, who have had their heart broken, who've been absolutely destroyed, who've had a major health problem, who have then ignited a fire to tell people what it's really like and not sugarcoated anything. That's genuine radio. When you're absolutely attracted to the headphones or the speakers, however you're listening to this, but you, and the fact that you can't stop listening because you don't want to miss out, because everything the person is saying makes a connection and you can get on board with. In that essence is extreme radio gold, and that is a broadcast you're always digging for. I can't remember what the question was.
No, you actually answered it perfectly. What would somebody who has a low level of consciousness but a hell of a lot of skill in radio do differently to you? And you've just described how you do it differently to them, which works in the same degree.
There you go. Excellent.
So, ladies and gentlemen, if you're a bad radio producer, whatever Thane just said, don't do that.
There you go. Exactly.
Or at least that's not what you're doing. The other question is, I mean, let's get on from the technical aspects and things like that. What was it that actually drove you? What was it that made you hungry and got you to do all those early mornings and late nights and deal with all the shit that you had to, and to beg and to borrow and to steal? What was it that actually motivated you? You mentioned trauma as something that happens to good radio hosts.
Yeah, there's levels of that. Before, but when I first started, it was because I needed a radio job. And then the second thing was someone told me I had a terrible voice, so I wanted to prove a point. The third thing is I was hungry, so I did it for the Contra to get some free meals along Ponsonby Road at the Open Lake Cafe. And then the next thing was I need to turn this into a business, because actually the Auckland music scene needs a radio station like this. So in my heart I find a cause, and then I wave the flag, and I do treat it along the lines of, I know everyone's trying to say, you know, I can't be too competitive, oh, leave them alone. That's what I like, being jarring, and I like putting a fire under other radio stations, and I like working hard for a radio survey, you know what I mean? I like to get out there myself on the front lines and wave the flag, shake the hands, run it like a presidential campaign, and get my message across. And then I think that's the only way you do it, as a person who is like a content director, a program director, and a breakfast host and stuff. I got to do all aspects of the job at one time so I can feel people's pain and understand, yep, that's the shittiest job in the world, sales, or yep, a promotions manager, I see how you understand. And also another thing, you've got to celebrate hard. Radio is can be, at times, very shitty and non-rewarding. You don't know who's listening, if anyone's listening at all, or why they said no to a radio campaign. I think you got to celebrate the small stuff. And once you do that, get out there with the team, getting to know them again personally. It brings together a bond, just the souls, the classic cult mentality. But, you know, everyone lives at the end of the day. So you get out there, you party with your team, you do it hard, and you just keep on going. And at the end of the day with George, it was just a matter of, you know, we nearly died. George only died because we didn't pay the IRD and we didn't pay our GST because the guy running it was just juggling balls. Personality, we had taken on Peter Ehrlich at the time, we were paying certain DJs, we got behind on musical rights and everything was against us, so we had no choice but to do a deal with a network to continue the brand on, you know. So that's kind of where we ended, and I only stayed on because what were they going to do with me? They needed to put the spiritual leader somewhere. So then I decided, yeah, I'm going to drive. So I did end up doing drive radio. Half the time I was intoxicated and turned out some of the best reading I've ever had and done in my life. It was a real weird scenario because I just don't slew when I'm drunk. So you'd have no idea. I just kind of like just went out there and did it. Not that I'm condoning it. Not everyone can do it. It's a special talent.
But well, as I like to say, there are some people who shouldn't drink and there are some people who shouldn't smoke weed. But fortunately, yeah. I'm neither of those people.
Okay, awesome. Yeah. So, get out there and do it hard. Okay, I forget where I'm at.
Well, that's actually another important aspect of it as well, is those small little victories and things of that nature, because I've been in this radio gig for 10 years now, and instead of focusing on things that are fun and interesting and that kind of thing, these are things that are dark and interesting, you know, like the real dark soul of humanity, and really, really kind of get into it. And towards the end of each show, you're either so elated because you're amazed at the content of this conversation because it was so fucking real, but on the other end of it, you're so depressed and so defunct because what just happened isn't going to be unlearned. You just learned something that changed the perspective of your life, and that's the whole reason why, perhaps like no other job, I've never been able to last maybe 3 or 6 months or something like that, but because of the variability, because I get broken apart and put back together again on a day-by-day basis as I do these shows, it's the only thing that can keep my interest.
Oh, that's good. You know, and I think exactly that's the way you do it. You've got to be all in, or you've got to do nothing. And you've got to expect everything and nothing at the same time as well. I mean, interviewing, I would remember winging some interviews and just going, oh, God, hopefully this guy's going to save it. And then have absolutely nothing from the talent. And then trying to take it to the editing suite and then just going to try and make the sound good. And then I've just got to listen, think about my listeners. What do they want to hear? And I remember interviewing some lady who said she would get her tits out or something. She was doing something, some bra thing for charity. And then, but she was a famous person and it seemed like just a short and straight thing. And then I asked her how big her breasts were. And then I went on for half an hour about everything else. And then I thought to myself, what do the listeners really want to get out of this interview? And I just thought, an introduction, one question, how big are your breasts? And then just wrap it up saying, congratulations, well done. And so I did literally a 45-second interview, you know, into just narrowing it down to the very mellow, you know, the marrow of it all. And I just thought, oh, yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you get that little bit of fun going, right?
Well, absolutely.
Well, just this morning, before this interview now, I interviewed a expert on narcissism who coined all the terms and phrases, you know, like hoovering and la 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 la. He's the guy who actually came up with all those terms back in the early 90s when there was no study.
Wow.
Right. Freaky interview, because as I'm speaking, I mean, the concept is everybody's got a little bit of narcissism, and there's a difference between healthy narcissism and fucking unhealthy narcissism, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. It's that belief in yourself and that actual ability to have power and not abuse it, to use it incorrectly, essentially, right? Now, where I was going with that is when you have a voice, when you have a microphone to amplify that voice, when you have a network underneath that to back that up as well, you have more power than the average individual.
Totally.
Do we put power in the wrong hands sometimes?
Yeah, I reckon I was thinking, you get these guys who are politicians, and then they kind of, someone's told them, wow, that really makes sense. Say that again. Then they'll say one thing or another, or just their opinion. And then someone will say, wow, you should be a politician. And then they'll go off, they'll groom themselves, they'll get a couple of those audio books, you know, motivational TED Talks, and they'll get into that. Some go to university. Some, are kind of like parents are pushing them because that's their legacy. But these are just normal people who go into Parliament. And then to get to dictate what I can watch, what I can say, what I see, where half my bloody wage goes, and with pretty much zero – we can't kind of like kill them at the end of the day. They can just go off and make these wacky laws or too many laws or things that really haven't been bench tested. And I just think that is kind of like some weird and wacky power. We are the people. Surely we need to have more of a say of who we put in there. These are people just like us. And I wondered why there hasn't been an outcry or an uprise, especially with the petrol prices and what have you in Auckland, and sorry, New Zealand. Why more people didn't say, well, let's kick off the revolution. I mean, there's more of us than them. And so I really believe New Zealand, that's power gone wrong and corrupt. But then again, I do live in Bali, one of the most corrupt places in the world.
Well, incidentally, the Transparency International just released their latest report. I believe I actually have it here. I'll bring it up on the screen for the viewing audience.
Let's have a look.
So, special edition, Corruption in New Zealand, from the chair. A whole bunch of things have actually gone down in New Zealand, right, regarding corruption, according to many of the activists that I personally have gone and talked to and things like this. And yet, when I look at the Transparency International piece about the corruption going on within the last year, we get downgraded, right? We've got downgraded from number one, least corrupt, to number two, perceived least corrupt. Remember, it's an important word, perceived.
Yeah.
And essentially what happens is they come out with these puff pieces. If you read through this article that says Special Edition Corruption in New Zealand, all it says is, yeah, a whole bunch of people think there might be corruption, but there probably isn't. There probably isn't.
it's just crazy. Absolutely crazy. Over here, there is a scenario where everything like, just say you get, are you in, where do you bounce? Are you based in the in
Green Bay, Auckland.
So Auckland. So if you were in like West Auckland, say Sandringham or Henderson, it's run by a local Banjar. Now the Banjar, you enter that area, you settle in, say, where you say Green Bay or whatever, it's run by a local, like the eldest family in there or the first connected to royalty. They run the cleanup, the laws, everything to do with that area. They maintain it and they do it really well. Police just stand by and handle the big stuff like murder and whatnot. You very seldom call the police. But the Banjar and the politics are done on a real local basis. And then the head of the Banjar of all of Bali is the local mafia type thing. Don't know the actual name. And they basically, the mafia is in hand in hand with the government so they can make things happen. And weirdly, wackily, it all kind of works. I feel more kind of like safe here because I've got a local, my local banja, than I do kind of in Auckland where I've got very sparse police to call.
Yeah, I mean, what are you going to do? Give John Banks a ring? Is it, hey, Banksy?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I think also the way that radio, mainstream radio, is given a whole lot of power, a power of influence, what we listen to every day, and shedding, and also the wackiness. I'm really over the wackiness in commercial radio. Let's pile a whole lot of ping pong balls in the boss's car. Let's repaint the boss's office in a colour that he doesn't like. Everybody come down wearing a mask of the co-host. Let's fat shame some guy on the team. It's just all a little bit cringe. And, you know, the next generation of tweens and teenagers listening to that crap that's thrown out every day, it's just infecting their minds and making them probably blind to what politicians are getting away with. No one cares about, you know, a lot of people care about Jacinda. No one cares about local politics or reading a book anymore because this bullshit's been shoved down their ears and in their minds, and a lot of politicians are getting away with a whole lot of stuff. Mm. So,
day before yesterday, I interviewed a former priest of the Church of Satan. And
wow.
And he was telling me about this experiment that just came out, this study about people who were paid to sit alone in a room with their own thoughts. And in case that got too much for them, they could electrocute themselves with a little buzzer. And approximately 60% of the people decided that being alone with their own thoughts was too much for them, and they chose to electrocute themselves instead. One guy electrocuted himself over 100 times.
Jesus, that's incredible. You know what? I think that's a bit of a gift. I don't mind my own company. When I used to go on holiday, it would take me 3 days to actually get comfortable and not want to check my phone or wonder what's happening back home or stop reading local media. But then again, yeah, I think I can actually, if someone said, all right, you're going to speak 2 weeks without talking to anybody or just being alone, I think I could get through it. Actually, I believe I could. Yeah.
And what this thinks is, like, some people are not at rest with their thoughts because, in fact, this is what the narcissist expert was explaining to me, is that the reason why people aren't okay with just being alone and not talking about anything is because they've got anxiety. Now what anxiety is your fight or flight response when you can't fight or fly. Okay, so, for example, the government is trying to kill me and enslave me and steal my tax money. I can't fight them. I can't run away from them. What the and the other fight or flight response is freeze. Yeah. And that's what people do intellectually, socially, spiritually. They freeze because they're under constant threat from so many levels, right? And I think as broadcasters,
God,
essentially...
Is this interview on demand? Yeah. I've got to hear this.
Oh,
wow, okay.
Well,
yeah.
the whole concept of this is that as broadcasters or anybody with any kind of media clout, essentially, you have to work extremely hard in order to have any clout. Like when you start with one subscriber, 15 subscribers, so on and so forth, and now I'm up to nearly 40,000, there's a great difference between my YouTube channel and somebody else's. Now, what that means is that I've actually put in the work and I've actually tried to create real content for real good society. And I've done that only because I've specifically asked people to give me like $5 a week, $1 a month, or whatever it is that they can afford. One of my listeners gives me $200 a month, and it's extraordinary because people are crying out for real content that is available, and they don't really care who's presenting it to them as long as they get brought good guests, good information, honesty, and integrity, and in journalistic reporting, they don't care. They will give their own money and time to it.
Well, you're doing a great job. I think it's the future of radio. Once the data and swallows up all the FM frequencies and they got to go digital, that's the only thing that these big corporates have over online radio and whatever way that you're expressing yourself in the, you know, in today's modern broadcasting. FM frequencies are going to die, and at the end of the day, everybody's going to be the same size, and hallelujah, I can't wait for that day.
Well, what was problematic is that we talked about during the interview about what narcissism is when you think that you're God, essentially. I'm all powerful, I'm everywhere, and that kind of thing. And what he said was that social media has allowed people to actually experience a digital version of godhood. You can be all-knowing, you can be everywhere, you can talk to everybody at once. And he said that his greatest fear is that these technologies are enhancing people now so powerfully that narcissism itself threatens to overtake the world like a plague, as people are obsessed with themselves and obsessed with each other, as opposed to really thinking about the real issues, what actually matters, what is actually going on. Those kind of things will fall by the wayside as people struggle to get the attention that they never got as children.
But narcissistic people, extreme ones, they will never, it's very hard to come back from, because you're living in this, you're living in your head, you're reading your own media, and you've got that kind of entitlement thing going on. You are your biggest fan, and you've got the God complex, and you probably harnessed a whole lot of friends around you to they believe you and are supporting your endeavors to go and do your thing. How can you ever come back from that? How can you ever work on yourself to become healthy? Because I suppose it would be like any other addiction, like alcohol or drug abuse and what have you. I don't know. I'm in denial about it. You know what I mean? It's a real tough scenario to get back from that.
You're right, actually, and that was actually one of the topics that came up during my other interview. And he's interviewed 40 narcissists, and I nearly cried when he told me this. He said that after his therapy, the narcissism went away. And he said he created it for depression, right? This therapy for depression. And it worked on narcissism and made that go away too. And then a deeper realization dawned. What if narcissism and complex post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, people have got stress disorders, panic attacks, things like that. What if they're actually just a natural response to trauma? And what if, like all trauma counseling, enough empathy, enough love, enough talking to it, enough cognitive behavioral therapy, and really thinking about what happened to me, how am I thinking about this, how is this affecting me, and turning what's subliminal into what is liminal, taking what is unseen and making it seen. Apparently you can evaporate this condition forever, right? And I suffer from narcissism. Well, actually, I don't suffer from it. Just everybody else has to. And now...
Yes.
You know? And like, we were talking about the discourse here. So here's a headline from the Daily Mail. YouTube to crack down on conspiracy videos. Video site to stop recommending blatantly false videos to users. And essentially, the first question that comes to mind of any reasonable person, who frickin' decides what's blatantly false, eh?
Yeah, oh, exactly. Absolutely. I haven't really been taken by any kind of, like, I'm one of these people where I see news come out from a couple of old people from Tauranga who have given someone $170,000 of all their life savings through a scam. I'm always kind of on and across that stuff. I think I've got the gift of going, this is a long shot scam. This ain't going to fly. And also fake news. I'm a real kind of fact checker when it comes to those things online. I think people, you've got to be a whole lot more savvier. But fake news, it's tough. I can see where people, especially on the news, not necessarily the scams, where you can believe, you know, that this, because then you're kind of like conspiracy theory, fake news. But is it fake news? Maybe that conspiracy guy and me kind of like wanting to believe certain bits and pieces.
Oh, you're going to love this headline then. This is out of the Telegraph in the UK. Government bans phrase fake news. If we'd been broadcasting in the UK right now, Thane, you could have cost me my fucking network account.
That's unbelievable.
You know, it's just like, that's what's problematic about it.
Well,
is that,
just to be brought up to the news.
Yeah, well, we don't know what we don't know until we know, you know. it's just, there's too much information and there's also too much bullshit at the same time. Because information is just information. It's not just truth. And I think that's why people have gotten caught in the trap of personality cults, all right? Like, for example, I like Mike Hosking. Yeah, I believe everything he says. You know, that kind of thing. It's just, you can't substantiate the basis of a view of reality on somebody else's opinion. If you have double-checked in the three-dimensional universe in which you exist, the things that they're saying, to test their veracity. Mm. Now, however, that is not taught to people. I don't think at all that discernment of truth or right from wrong is taught to children at a young age. I think they're taught to sit, be quiet, listen to the authority figure and do what they tell you and stay out of trouble and keep your head down and don't shine like the star you are. That's what they teach us.
Absolutely. I know the kids' school that I go to, my kids go to, that we pay a ton of cash per term for them to go to. They got this thing called homework, after work homework class. And basically they finish school around 2:20 in the afternoon and then the rest till 3 o'clock is homework. And then I said, hey, how's the homework thing going at school, honey? That's my daughter. And she said, oh, good. We mostly just go out and play. And the teacher checks their phone. And that's pretty much, did you do your homework? No. Oh my God, this is unbelievable. What the bloody hell are we paying all these fees for? Anyway, it's probably a universal story.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. In fact, speaking of like this, you mentioned the word cult before and how pretty much everybody's part of some kind of cult, right?
Yeah, sure.
In some way, shape, or form. Here's cult indoctrination practices, and I read this, and it was really shocking to read it because I was just thinking about when I went to high school and all of that sort of thing, and I read this list of cult indoctrination principles: fluorescent lighting, a central authority figure that can't be questioned, group herd mentality to ostracize the outsiders, and poor nutrition, and sleep deprivation. I was like, and what was it? Repetition of boring, pointless things, tasks.
Wow, jeez.
So the realization on me dawned that the government itself is not only a cult, but it's a self-replicating cult that's actually got cult indoctrination systems specifically designed to keep the entire population indoctrinated into the one cult, the cult of New Zealand, the cult of America, the cult of the UK, and so on and so forth. Now, this may sound really dark and bad or whatever, but imagine if they didn't do that. Imagine if everybody just had all these really crazy, disparate beliefs. Nobody knew how to read the same languages or blah, 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 blah. Right. However, that's the fear talking, ladies and gentlemen. Think about it. Everybody knows right from wrong, right? That's why they call it conscience. Con meaning together, science meaning to know. From the Latin, we know together what is right and from wrong. And I think that if you've got a society that isn't being cult indoctrinated to not thinking and to submitting to authority and stuff like that, if they didn't have that happen in the first place, a shockingly large amount of the problems that we see in the generalized population wouldn't fucking exist in the first fucking place.
I reckon that stuff there is in the first chapter of How to Brainwash a Country, you know, for the book for governments, the training manual. I watch a lot of media. I'm a little bit of a news junkie, and just the way prime ministers speak in a rhythmic form, and just the way the underlined words that they use, you know, especially when Jacinda was delivering the whole Kiwi Homes type thing and giving these outrageous targets, but just the way she held herself, the direct look at camera and the kind of Kiwi can-do mentality, we're going to make these targets, this is what's going to happen. And then it just comes out that the target's ridiculous, the CEO's quit, this is never going to happen, you know, but how we can all just go along with it and just go, okay, all right, well, she's onto something. And, you know, we're just brainwashed in New Zealand to follow everybody. You know, like you say, we want to. It's a sheep mentality. What else have we got going on? Nothing.
Well, not New Zealand anyway, but a sheep mentality, but
yeah, there you are. Yeah.
Well, and also, this is another concept as well, is that that empty vessel of patriotism, you know, my country, my country, my country. And I think it was Thomas Jefferson who said, my country is the world and my religion is to do good. And I thought to myself, why border yourself off? And however, there are borders in this world. There are different cultures. There are things that you'd go into that you just really don't fully understand, and you have to live in them for a couple of months or whatever before you kind of get down the idiosyncrasies, like, you're supposed to toot the horn when you go through this tunnel in Wellington.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. I have found it interesting being here in Bali and the fact that we're in a Muslim and Hindu country and the way that they have embraced their religion and how it takes up, say, 70% of your entire lives. Everything they do is motivated under the doing good under the eye of whatever God that they're praising at the time, and how whole countries can stop down because of festivals and ceremonies and what have you, and how in this modern time, and you've been given faith, because you know, there's no pornography or access to any kind of sites over here. You have to use a VPN if you want to be on Pornhub. But yeah, gambling, not happening, bad language, not happening. You're allowed YouTube in Indonesia, but very limited things that you can have a look on. So it's all very guarded and it's very censored and controlled over here. And people haven't veered away from flying the flags and from committing to their religion and ceremonial, you know, kind of like praises and ceremonies here. Even they do have access to all kind of technology. They live their life firmly behind religion and the flag. It's just been totally from school, you know, kind of set in motion. School starts in Indonesia at something like 8 and finishes at about 11. And then you kind of like get on to learn how to work. You either work over here or you don't survive.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's a different kind of, I've had a different kind of life, but I'm kind of getting used to it.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, that reminds me of a clip I took from, I just recorded it today, actually. I'll see if I can get it up for us. Look, we always try to escape our pain, and we always try to like find solutions to problems and things like that, so we don't have to suffer through them anymore. But sometimes, in trying to avoid our pain, we wind up actually fucking up society amongst us, because if people can't experience their pain, if they can't experience their suffering, then they don't actually know what it is that they're doing with their life. Now, in that spirit, I just want to play this 57-second clip from Brave New World. I'll see if this one I can get it to play.
I don't want comfort.
Then what do you want? Unpleasantness? Suffering? Pain?
Yes, I want all of that. And all of the things you've done away with. I want danger, I want poetry, I want goodness, I want sin, I want freedom.
Put more directly, what you are really saying is that you claim the right to be unhappy.
All right, then. Claim the right to be unhappy.
But that also means the right to be sick, to be crippled, to be insane, the right to grow old and ugly and wrinkled, the right to protect yourself from violence, the right to kill or be killed, the right to have too little to eat,
and the right to hope, to love.
Yes, even the right to fall in love and then be spurned, betrayed, left racked with pain and jealousy. Is all of that really what you want, Mr. Savage?
That's exactly what I want. I claim all of it.
And I was thinking, that kind of like moved me to tears, sort of thing, when I heard that for the first time, because I see our society moving to a point where to feel real emotions is almost looked down upon now. To be a real human being is not good enough, apparently.
Yeah, totally. And when it is real, just like the headline, it becomes a clickbait headline on the Herald website, you know what I mean? When someone that has been exposed to realness and gone out there and done something or failed something, you get turned into selling Harvey Norman couches. How very disappointing.
I remember a friend of mine in Liverpool. He was talking to this security guard outside Tesco's, and he says, "Oh, what did you used to do for a living, mate?" And he says, "Well, actually, I used to be in the banking system." And he goes, "Oh yeah." And he goes, "Yeah, I made millions of dollars and traded stocks and all of that kind of stuff." "Yeah, what happened?" Mm-hmm. And he goes, "Well, I saw my bosses that were cheating on the customers, and I turned a whistleblower on them." And he goes, "Whoa, man, that's amazing. Good on you, bro. How'd that work out?" And he goes, "Why do you think I'm working at Tesco's?"
Exactly.
I mean, it's like don't bite the hand that feeds you is one of those lessons. I think Mark Passio is a good commentator online about natural law principles and what real morality is, you know. And one time he was accosted by a police officer who told him to stop spreading his message that you've got to be good to other people and you've also got to punish badness or at least critique it when you're around here, when you've still got your freedom of speech. And the cop told him to stop saying that, right, and then threatened to arrest him. Now, the cop was armed, right? Now, even though if he stood on his principle, he might have been shot. So it's about a time and a place. There's a time to fight, and there's a time to just bide your time.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the word fuck on radio? I've always thought that commercial radio, slightly when I was at Georgia Theomisis, we were all the time, not because I wanted to make anything or content more punchy or go, ooh, because that's kind of how I... kind of like, I don't know, so brought up, it's kind of like the language I use. It was just in my mix. It just came naturally to me. But these days, you can't, there's a whole varied words you can't say on the radio. And you kind of have to, you're all watered down. We remove those from our
network because it's just the language of humanity evolved over thousands of years. And I think that if you artificially restrict people's use of that language, you stop them from being able to form their own ideas the way that they want to form them. And eventually they'll stop forming ideas altogether.
True. That's good. Have you been in commercial radio at all, or did you give it a bit of a spell on your time, you know?
Well, my intro to it was Vapi Kupinga on Urban Māori Radio, my auntie Vapi. She had me on her show a couple of times, in the studio a couple of times, and that's what kind of gave me a bit of a taste for it. And at the time I was making YouTube videos and hanging out with John Eisen from Uncensored Magazine, the New Zealand Journal of Natural Medicine, that kind of thing. So, and then I got noticed by an American producer. They gave me a co-host position with an American host. Then they fired the American host and gave me the show. So that's how that works.
Wow, that's really good. I reckon you've, from me, like if I was the EGQ coming from a, you've got so much, you've got a good opinion. It's exciting stuff, and you've got these facts and figures in front of you that just make really interesting radio. I haven't listened to a lot of online radio, and I haven't listened to a lot of talk. I have on planes, but not in the real world. But I might just give your radio station a go now. That's my kind of lesson, you know.
That's high praise indeed, Zane. I really appreciate that.
Got it, kid. Well done.
I also want to thank Denny as well. Our man Denny with the accordion for introducing us.
That's it. Boy, I've got that guy on many different radio shows that I've been on. I've always enjoyed it. One of my favorite things is when he is such a perfectionist on that instrument that when he gets it wrong, it sends him in some kind of panicked, anxiety-riddled kind of like he just has to get it right, and then it just all goes to fuck. And it's pretty hilarious to watch, but he kind of goes with it, you know. He's dedicated, isn't it, old Dennis?
Yeah. Well, I've actually got a bunch of recordings on this computer of him. He came to my birthday party and gave us his curry meal and all of these other songs and stuff. And we recorded them on the Mac down there by the fireplace. It was
God,
great.
God, he's good. Fucking yeah. Oh, I miss that guy. He is very, very funny. You got to add a little bit of spice too. You can talk, but you also got to have a bit of a laugh.
Yeah, well, and I think what Denny reminds me of is he's a caricature of himself, all right? And I can relate to that because a lot of people who are really good at what they do become caricatures of themselves, and that's why they're called characters.
Yeah, totally.
You know? And I think he's a good reminder in my life that it's not a bad thing to just be a character.
Absolutely, and check out his laugh. I don't know if you've got any audio of old Dennis' laugh. He's got one of the best laughs in radio. He loses it. That laugh is contagious. It's pretty amazing.
I want to put it in a can and so that when you wind the thing up and it pops out at you.
Where are you finding all your people to talk to? What's the process there that you're using?
Well, I'd like to take credit for it, but in truth, it's actually my listeners.
Right.
Well, here's the thing. If you realize that you're an idiot, you understand that when you ask a question of intelligent people, they're going to give you intelligent answers that you're not going to fully understand unless you sit there and you fucking listen for a couple of hours, right? So I'll ask my listeners a question. Like, for example, give me somebody to interview. And it doesn't matter what the topic is, if it's interesting or whatever. And then I'll go and I'll watch a video of that person and go, fuck, mate, we've got something here. And then we'll bring that person on and... almost time after time, I'll get these two statements out of them at some point. Vinny, you've hit the nail on the head. Or, man, this is one of the best interviews I've ever done. Right? Because that's just what I do. You know, other people find it, well, wow, it was really great. It was one of the best interviews I've ever done. You know, for them, this is a new experience. But for me, I try to make every single show that I do the best show I've ever done.
Yeah, you can really tell... you can already tell that. I mean, it's a very comfortable interview. You know what you're talking about. Me personally, it's sweltering here. It's 32 degrees. During this interview, I've folded some laundry. I've also washed my hands a couple of times because I was out by my pond replacing rocks. Whilst we were talking, I was just doing all these things. And you've just, it's been a very comfortable, relaxing, therapeutic and informal, informative we chat.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the whole idea, because I didn't like the original talk radio format of, oh, now in the news and such and such. They always give a date, don't they? They always give a date. Mm. They always give the time. And what that does is it dates it and it times it, and so it doesn't fucking age well, does it? But if you're talking to a person who's actually done something with their fucking life, and you talk to them about their life and what they actually feel and what they've learned over it, that shit lasts forever.
You know what, and you just have to Google. You've seen, I've had so many, like, there's been a lot of failure too. Like, I've had stuff go good, I've had stuff go wrong. But I suppose at the end of the day, and, you know, I've got into radio when I was like 15 years old. I'm 44 now. You just got to keep on going. Just got to keep on going and, you know, and be involved and stay up with the play. And also now I've got the luxury of just picking and choosing of projects that, you know, that I kind of want to do. And I've done my time in New Zealand radio and New Zealand media. I'm working on another project at the moment, which is more of a like a worldwide, like yours kind of media project. And weirdly, it's to do with social media influencers. Crazy. So the chat we talked about with your social media and narcissism and what have you, it's just been almost did my research for me there. So it was that good. And yeah, but you just keep on going. No matter how many failures, you're learning from everything. You're taking that away. And then as long as you're happy at the end of the day, that's kind of where it kind of sits. If I can go and go, fuck, if I die tomorrow, I've had a good life. I've achieved everything I was supposed to do. I brought three kids into the world. I've got a loving wife. And I've just had the best Nazi Goreng money can buy. And I'm fine. I'm kind of happy.
Well, yeah, I made that point on the show the other day, is that the reason bad memories, you never forget them, is because your mind is trying to remind you, don't repeat that experience. And the reason why good memories disappear almost instantly is it's your brain trying to remind you, do good things today as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like, I've learned from some things and I've kind of fucked up other things and I've had extreme success in other things. But, I mean, you know, there's still away from a great radio gig, and you know, I just remember, just at the end of the day, it comes down to quality of life. And if your life is radio and if your life is media and if that's what gets you to your happiness, then, you know, hey, continue and go and do it. But I've kind of like what I've lost over the years is time with my family, because when you're an entrepreneur and you're doing this for your paycheck and you're out and no one's going to give you any other money, when I was setting up, you know, the TV with the radio stations and stuff, you lose that connection with your family. You're not bringing up your kids the right way or the way that you set out to do. You lose all those moments that you kind of like just fly by. And it's true. Old people are right when they say, boy, time, go with it. I blinked, and now I'm 55. So what I'm my dedication now is to give to my family, make sure they're seeing and reading and experiencing the right stuff. They've got healthy minds, they're well fed and happy, and I want to turn out some really great individuals. And so the time away from dedicating my entire life, like the whole cult thing, that's gone. Family's in, and I just take on projects when I can.
You've actually just kind of highlighted on what the artist Banksy said. He said, people who do a lot for a living, particularly activists, they don't need to know when to quit. They need to know when to take a break.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. And also be vulnerable. You know, when I was doing the New Zealand radio, I was like, well, it's going to be tough not being Thane Kirby. I'm coming to Indonesia. It's 200 million people. No one's going to give me a freebie when I walk into the joint, or, you know what I mean? You don't have the luxury of being a personality or a media type person. You're so it was my, like, that whole narcissistic thing. It was hard giving up. But once you do it and you've got a bigger picture, then it kind of becomes easy. I did it kind of like for the right reasons. I thought I'd end my radio career with saying the wrong thing on a massive scale and being booted off. And then, you know, living my life as a headline until I died of some kind of cancer.
Well, you're still good. And,
yeah, true.
One can only hope.
I was reading the paper. I was still reading the paper the other day. They said the cancer cure is a year away.
But I saw articles like that every year for the last 10 years.
Yeah.
All right, and I've seen. I think it was 2,700 documents or studies or something like that showing that cannabis cures cancer since 1973, or something of that nature. If Tig Stopford from the Hemp Foundation would fucking correct me on that one, I'd love it. But something ridiculous is in the air. If there's even anybody alive today that questions that cannabis can cure cancer, why is it illegal? How much is a round of chemo? $50,000. And does the doctor get killed? Kickbacks when he gives people that chemo? Yeah. And does chemo kill 96% of the patients? Yeah. And okay, I understand the dynamic now. Money is why.
Yeah. Fuck. Just so disappointing, eh? It's just so crazy. I got to update my health insurance too. Thanks for the reminder.
You're welcome. Always helping right over here at the Vinnie Eastwood Show, ladies and gentlemen.
You know what? I just think New Zealand produces some of the best weed in the whole world. I just don't know why we can't do the whole medical marijuana thing. Tick, that's an instant. She's going to get a lot of points for that, you know, just Cindy. And then also, so we can ease off on all the other bloody taxes that New Zealanders pay. It's a, you know what? Compared, I can fill my car up in Indonesia. I know we've got population and everything, but I can fill it up for $30. You know what I mean? And for childcare and everything like that, it's a whole lot more affordable than living in that overtaxed, low-paying country.
Well, you sound like Jesse Ventura, former governor of Minnesota. He left his home country. He's a former Navy SEAL. He left his country specifically for the same reasons you just stated. It's overtaxed, it's overcontrolled, and he prefers to live in Mexico, you know?
Yeah,
He only knows one Spanish word. Cerveza?
Oh, I love that guy. That's awesome.
You know, and I think that's maybe what a lot of freedom-loving Westerners are actually starting to cotton on to, is that, hey, maybe these places that gave us all these opportunities, maybe the hand that hold us up is actually the hand that was holding us down.
Yeah, too. And also, what a big lingo. I'm going to go into a different culture. I'm going to be one of 200,000 people. You know, right now in Indonesia, there's 399 Kiwis, apparently. And we're all scattered throughout the place who are like residents. And but you can't be a racist if you go to another country. You know, you are the you are literally the minority, and you have got to be respectful and abide by the customs and get to know the place. And we are currently going to be learning Bahasa, which is the local language here. And, you know, we're doing that to try and get ahead.
Well, yeah. You know, it's interesting, though, because we've been looking at a lot of the documents coming out of the UN. We just signed this UN migration pact and things like that, which is going to significantly increase the migration that's coming to New Zealand. Now, I think it was back in 2008 during the election where John Key became inaugurated as the Chancellor of New Zealand. And Winston Peters was saying the statistic that in Finland... They had approximately 500 immigrants per year into that country. And in the same year, New Zealand had 50,000. Now, I think it was last year or the year before, Auckland alone had 80,000. And all the rest peripherally has also increased as well. Now, I think it was Stefan Molyneux, who's a philosopher. He actually wasn't allowed to speak here in New Zealand because the left shut him down, kind of thing. He was explaining the historical context of it, and you have a look at the timeline. What mass migrations have ever happened throughout history, and what was the results of them? And it turns out that every single time, civil war and people at each other's throats, and then a invader comes in and takes over and imposes some kind of rule or empire. That's what happens every single goddamn time. And usually it's the people who invade who are the ones who sent the immigrants in the first place to destabilize everything. So that if nobody's speaking the same language, if they're not raised in the same environment, if they don't have roots there, they don't have so much of a national identity, so that when a foreign invader comes to restore order, they don't resist them or see them as invaders. They see them as coming to restore order.
God, smart, isn't it? It's one way to do it.
Give the devil their due, mate.
We're just talking about the devils the other day and just saying how I wonder if anyone else has had this conversation, how, you know, Nazi Germany and Hitler, just shocking. But boy, that guy knew branding, didn't he? He had signs up everywhere.
Yeah, I want them red, I want them white, I want them to pop!
I mean, there must have been a brand or a marketing guy. What do you reckon to this? And he goes, more flags. You're crazy, there's already a big flag there, there's two giant ones next. No, more. I want them on the cars, I want them on the hats, I want them on the badges, I want them on the uniforms, I want them on the columns. That guy had signage.
He was up Oprah before Oprah. Everybody gets a flag. Everybody gets a flag.
That's a lot. He was probably giving away for free. Unbelievable. But he understood marketing. No one marketed better than Hitler.
Yeah. I mean, and that's what, well, except, interestingly enough, Trump's campaign advisor, the guy who came up with the build the wall, drain the swamp, all these slogans, right?
Yeah, right.
They're actually a think tank company, right? And they pitched that exact same shit to like Mike Huckabee and a whole bunch of these other Republicans, and they said, no, that's really cheesy and immoral and horrific and dishonest and things like that. We can't support that kind of thing. No, we would never do it. These are corrupt Republicans saying this. And then they go and they represent that thing to Donald Trump, and he's like, you're all right, man.
Yeah. But I reckon there's two different things. Donald can deliver it, and he's dynamic. Well, not even dynamic. He holds it well in a debate and whatever, you know. He's a big bullish. He's the pub owner that's been marketing his little pub at the end of the street. And he can stand up in a certain environment and just nail it. Mm. And that, as you should see, that's a very appealing to some Americans.
Well, yeah. I mean, in fact, the narcissism expert, Sam Vaknin, he said he predicted that Donald Trump would become the president of the United States 7 months before he even announced his candidacy. All right.
Wow, how about that?
And the way he did it is he looked at the American consciousness. Where is the American consciousness at? And do they want a vicious, narcissistic psychopath to rule everything in this environment of chaos that's been created? And the answer was absolutely yes, because he represents precisely the American consciousness. I don't give a fuck.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's totally it. Have you been to America? America is a fun place to visit.
Unfortunately, I may never, unless diplomatic passport. Yes, because well, fortunately, my gig allows me to hobnob with certain highbrow individuals, such as yourself. And so, and because I'm such a charming cunt, I often ask for people for favours. And she's like, "Hey, could you recommend it?" So, if a recommendation comes in from some of the senators, congressmen, congresswomen that I've interviewed, local city councillors of Los Angeles, and things of that nature, that over the years I've amassed this network. Theoretically, I might be able to get into the United States, and the reason for this whole rigmarole, I've got cannabis convictions.
Oh, God, boring. Just, I mean, you got to get over that. Can they, was the right word repealed or whatever? Now that cannabis is legal in most of the states?
Well, even so, they still have a criminal record system that's international. So when Nando Tanchos, I think it was in 2006, passed the Clean Slate Bill, it means that after 7 years of not committing any crimes or getting any convictions or anything, non-violent ones, non-prisonable ones, you know, then they'll be wiped clean and you can go to your job interview, she'll be right. But what he didn't state, or at least what wasn't made totally known to the public at the time until I had to research into it for myself, is that that doesn't count internationally. So Interpol gets all the records and things of that nature, and they will ask you, do you have any criminal convictions or anything like that? And if you say no, they could still look it up and find out that, actually, yes, you do. So it's not international legislation.
It's going to be even worse if you lie to the Americans. True.
And the thing is, it's interesting, in order to speak to Americans, all I've had to do is speak the truth. But in order to go to America, all I'd have to do is lie. Isn't that sad?
Or change your name.
Well, yeah, that's actually one of the interesting things. It was, I think it was Grace Hayden. She's a former New Zealand police detective. She fucking told me about that. Hey, why don't you just change your name? And it was, wait a second. I can just change my name by deed poll and then... But I'm Vinnie Eastwood. I'm the Vinnie Eastwood show. What am I going to do? You know, I mean, Clint Eastwood didn't change his fucking name. I shouldn't have to.
Yeah. Oh, well, she's a long road. So I don't know what you're going to do there. You could get a good... the recommendations would help, but you could get a good consultant, you know, and see if you can get a case together. Mm. Or can't you marry some American or... I don't know if you want to get into America that much.
Already married, so to a South African who doesn't have New Zealand citizenship. So.
Gotcha.
Have you ever met a guy? I'm like one of those guys who gets themselves into such fucked up situations that when you try to help, it just gets worse. You know?
Yeah, I understand. Absolutely. Yeah. Jeez.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the interview, Thane. We have a couple of minutes left in the broadcast. We have some time left for a little bit of self-promotion. So if you would please, go right ahead.
Okay. You can check me out on Instagram, just at Thane. Thane's a weird name to spell, T-H-A-N-E-K-I-R-B-Y. And what else? That's pretty much me across all social. I'm working on a little radio station at the moment. You can check out mellowfm.com. And that's pretty much me at the moment. If you're in Indonesia, give me a shout out.
All right. Thank you very much. And now, ladies and gentlemen, I would also like you to direct your eyes to the homepage of the VinnieEastwoodShow.com and check out the Kiwi Bank account there if you'd like to send us between $1 and $5 a month. Whatever you want to send through, weekly or monthly, is absolutely greatly appreciated from the New Zealand listening audience to support your local content providers.
It's like you're busking now, aren't you? Delivered the goods, the entertainment. It's time now to pay up.
Well, here's the thing. If you give people something for free and then you ask them for something of their own free will that they do not have to give, it is only the most generous and the decent who are willing to lose something and gain nothing in return who will donate. And those are the kind of people who are less judgy when I bring on guests that they don't fucking like and say things that they don't fucking like. So, you know.
Good luck, mate. I think you're doing a great job regardless. And please, if you're listening to this right now, please give some money to this guy.
Yeah. Become a Patreon at patreon.com/Vinnie Eastwood. That's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question in Eastwood. Like, go ahead. Make my news. Thank you so much for watching, ladies and gentlemen. And thank you, Thane, for giving me your time on this hot goddamn barley day, brother. Thank you.
Absolutely. Keep up the good work. Well done, mate. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen. We'll catch you again sometime.